Bandwidth for November has been provided by CacheFly, the fastest, most reliable CDN in the business. CacheFly delivers all of our content here at 5x5, and they're the best. Check them out at cachefly.com, CacheFly, and let them know that you heard about them here on 5x5.
I have pressed the podcast button.
I'm recording.
Yep, I'm also recording.
Here we go. 3, 2, 1. We recorded this episode on November 17th, 2015. This is On the Grid episode 142. This week, we have some follow-up about the next great American invention, and we talk about the symbols we create and rally around. Here we go. Welcome back from Canada, Andy. Was it like a different country up there?
It was. Their money is cool. It's made of like plastic.
Also looks really cool, too.
How was your talk, Andy? Did you actually put it together, or did you just wing it?
Oh, yeah, of course I put it together. No, I was prepared. I went up there prepared.
Good.
The whole conference was a bigger deal than I thought it was. It was like they had a whole convention center rented out, and there was like, you know, giant signage they had installed all over the place, and they had made like sculptures that were for the event that were there, screens everywhere. It was kind of a big deal. But no, it was good. My talk went well. I ended up giving it twice because somebody unfortunately had to drop out of their speaking engagement in the last minute, which means that they had an open slot and they just asked me to do it again because they needed to fill it with somebody. So I ended up doing it twice. Mm-hmm. And the first time I would say went very well. I was excited to do it a second time actually because I got to practice it and I figured first time would be okay, second time would be better. And actually made quite a few modifications to the presentation itself in between the first and second time.
Sure.
And second time, well, you'll appreciate this. I'm sure you will. So there was three stages at the event. There was like a big main stage and like a giant auditorium, probably like 3,000 seats maybe. And it was maybe 2/3 full. And then there was a smaller stage in another building that was still auditorium stadium seating. That was kind of like the second stage. And I was on the third tier stage, the little person stage, which was actually just kind of like some chairs around a much smaller stage in an area below the main stage. Probably maybe sat a couple hundred people in the chairs. So when this person had to cancel their talk, they moved a bunch of people around because the person that canceled their talk was on the main stage. And they looked at me and they were like, not putting him on the main stage. That would be a mistake. So they moved somebody else who was supposed to speak on the small stage up to the main stage. And I took their spot on the small stage. The whole point was that there was a lot of confusion. No one really knew where anybody was. And all of the printed schedules everyone had were wrong. So they kept on telling people to refer to their online schedules. So anyway, the first time I gave the talk, same stage both times, the audience was pretty full. I would say the chairs were 85% occupied. It was a good turnout. And the second time, it was looking a little lighter. It was probably maybe like 2/3, somewhere between 2/3 and half full. And the person who went up to introduce me, he said at first, like, if anybody's here to see this other speaker, his name was Patty Donnelly. Patty's been moved upstairs, so you need to go to the upstairs stage. And I was off stage, not yet introduced. And what I did is I went, no, you're not going upstairs. You're staying down here to see me, right? And then 3/4 of the people got up out of their chairs and walked out. And there was basically nobody left, which I guess you should come to expect when you give a talk twice, right? Like all the people had the option to go to my talk the first time. These are people that either chose not to the first time and then were kind of like, there was no one else to go to, or they wanted to the first time, but something else won out in their sort of selection. So it was pretty funny. I have not been that embarrassed in a long time.
It just seems like a very cruel thing to do.
Yeah, well,
introducing Andy Mangold. Before we bring on Mr. Mangold, you're listening to the On the Grid podcast. If you want to be listening to Back to Work, that's actually over there.
If you're looking for cereal, cereal's upstairs on the main stage.
There are much better options for you. Why don't we just list all the better options before this thing gets started? There's probably a whole list of 100 better podcasts you could be listening to. So get out of here. Don't bother. We don't need your patronage. Anyway, welcome Andy Mangold.
This episode of On the Grid is brought to you by Audible, the leader in audio entertainment. Let's list books that are better than this podcast to listen to. Harry Potter. I'll start it off. Harry Potter. Never listened to them. Probably better than this podcast.
Now coming to the stage, Andy Mangold.
Oh, what's that? All three quarters of you left. Oh, no.
Andy, we're just going to turn off the mic because there's just one guy in the front. You can just yell at him.
Oh, no. It's the most embarrassed man. Welcome to the stage. The world's most ashamed asshole.
Was it still fun, though? Did you have a good time the second time, at least?
Oh, sure. I did my thing. Second time was high pressure, too, because I had met in between. There's a couple of speakers there, and the one speaker, her name is Annie Atkins. I did not know her name, but apparently she's a graphic designer on a lot of different movies, particularly on the Grand Budapest Hotel. So she did all the crazy graphic design work at the Grand Budapest Hotel, and she's wonderful. She was so great to talk to. And some people were telling her about my talk, and she was like, I can't wait to go. And I was like, you shouldn't go. It's going to be bad. And she came anyway. So I was high pressure because she was sitting in the front row. She actually is the one that took the picture I sent you of
oh, nice.
Me
good.
Standing on stage with a giant arrow pointing to me saying, I am part of the problem. Yeah, so it was fine. The first time was good. And I was kind of, there's a lot of people that wanted to discuss things afterwards, and nobody yelled at me, which I thought was
really?
Nice.
I thought you were going to get yelled at.
I thought I was
time.
Too. And I said this to other people, and they were like, why would you get yelled at? I was like, I don't know. I feel like people are going to be like, reverse racism. This guy's pointing out problems and saying words.
You didn't get yelled at for anything, your talk, no. Anything you've said in the past, nothing?
Well, I don't often get yelled at for things I've said just in general when I'm
Maybe
places.
Maybe someone tapped you on the shoulder and he said, are you Andy Mangold, the guy from that podcast? Uh-huh. I hate the thing that you said on episode 67. Yeah, remember 2 years ago?
I don't think people have the courage to do that, generally.
Okay.
Yeah, no one was mad. Everyone, a lot of people said that they were thinking about similar things. One person told me they were working on a thesis project that was related to these ideas, and they wanted to show it to me when they were done, and I was like, this is great. And a couple teachers were like, okay. Oh, that's the thing. So, like, we talked on the show last week about how I was talking about privilege and power and whiteness and maleness and design and how it's kind of embedded itself in our language. And I talked about how I didn't really have a way to end it, and I never really came up with a great way to end it. I basically ended it by being like, look at these things I'm talking about. Let's all talk about them more. Okay, bye. And most people were like, okay, I see what you are saying. I buy it a little bit. So what do we do? And I was like, ooh,
I don't know.
I mean, there's some easy things, right? So most people I was like, especially if you're in a position to be a teacher, one of the most important things you can do, I think, is expose young designers to the work of a much more diverse set of people than they are typically going to be exposed to. Which is a lot of work on your part as a teacher. I've done it before to try and find like people from other countries, people that don't speak English that are sort of really important graphic designers in history or had some sort of very meaningful work. It's hard to find them, but I think that's an important thing you can do. It seems like a fairly low-hanging fruit thing, right? Just as much as possible, expose yourself and others to the work of all kinds of different people. But beyond that, I was like, sorry, this wasn't one of those talks where there's like a thing you can do at the end.
It would be against your way anyway. It's not the Andy Mangold way to tell people what to do.
Yep.
Just to talk for a while and then be like, was that bad? Question mark.
Put that on my business card. Was that bad? I do a bad. So yeah, it was good. And then I ate a pea meal sandwich and I met a couple friends in Toronto, which was great. It was a cool trip. Very fun. Toronto is just like Chicago. And Chicago, I've always said, is just like if New York was clean. So that's what Toronto is also. You know, if you're dramatically oversimplifying. It's got a very similar kind of texture to the sort of urban fabric and the sort of rhythm as a place like New York. Everyone walks slowly, though. That's the thing. People walk so slowly in certain cities. And like, I know that I'm not actually in a rush. Right? I'm walking behind some people. I have nowhere to be. I'm on no schedule, and I know it's happening. I'm conscious of this, but I cannot make my legs go slowly enough to walk at the same speed that they're walking, and I have to just walk around people the whole time.
Yeah, I understand that. So, I think it's just too—it's too awkward to like pretend you're not walking slowly behind somebody, and you're like conscious of modifying your own pace. It's too difficult.
Yeah,
you can't do it without. It's like remembering to breathe. You're like, oh, I've become conscious. You know what it is? It's like when you realize you have to move your arms a certain way when you walk. Like, have you ever been, like, on video and somebody's like, don't move your arms like that, move them like this? And you're like, I never thought about that, but now I'm going to move them very awkwardly because I don't understand what to do. Modifying the pace
of your walk. Well, it's weird, Matt, because you do constantly try and flap your arms like wings when you're walking, which I've never brought up. I figured that was a thing. But that's part of your character, I would say.
People never point it out, but it does seem weird.
There are these things about all of us that you never notice until you see yourself either on video or in a reflection.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most notorious moments of this for me is I had, you know, three roommates going through college. And one time, in my mind's eye, we were like all roughly the same size. And like always, we were just like, well, you know, four people, same size. And then one particular moment, we were walking in front of some building with like a, you know, shiny window, and I caught my reflection with these people, and I was like, oh my god, I'm a giant. I am so much bigger than these people. And I had no, like, my perception was not that way. That happens sometimes.
Yeah. I think actually one of the biggest ones that people have that I feel like I'm very immune to at this point is hearing your own voice for the first time.
Oh yeah.
Recording your own voice and then hearing it back.
I remember those days.
Very jarring at first. Yeah. I don't know. I don't get that anymore.
Yeah,
but I remember the first time it happened, and it was very weird, and I didn't like it, not one bit.
The one thing about this is actually true. You know, I bought a jacket on eBay. You know, we talked about jackets last week, and I've been looking for a particular jacket for a while. I bought one on eBay from a man in Ottawa, which is near Toronto, and the shipping was going to be expensive across the United States border, so it happened to work out that he was going to ship it to the hotel I was in Toronto. It was going to work out perfectly, so I didn't really pack a jacket because I had a jacket that was going to arrive in Toronto for me, but then at the last minute, he backed out and was like, oh, I just found out if I ship the jacket this way, we won't be protected through eBay, blah, 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 so I was stuck in Toronto without a jacket. And you know, Matt, I was thinking back to your jacket, and I really could have used that, I think.
I found out that actually a lot of people can use that.
Did you get a lot of feedback, a lot of positive notes?
A lot of positive, not just positive feedback. We've collected over $7 million on Indie Kickstart GoGo.
That is a lot of positive feedback.
Yeah. Not only that, we've actually decided we're going to continue adding features as rewards. So like if you get, let's say you donate $100,000. You
That's
get
a
reward, which is adding whatever feature you want to the jacket.
To everyone's jacket or just my jacket?
Yeah, no, to every single person's
jacket. Everyone's jacket.
Just so that everybody's gets better, obviously. The more stuff, the better. Wow. So far, at least 20 people have done that.
Wow.
So we have a lot of additional chargers.
I'm doing some quick napkin math over here. That's a lot of features and a lot of dollars.
I mean, they're paying for it, so it's fine. It'll kind of roll into manufacturing. It's totally fine. I'm telling you, it's mainly just additional chargers. So, which just makes it more timeless. The more chargers, the better. The longer lasting it's going to be, the more devices it supports. Just makes it a better jacket.
Well, you did just send over this list of the features, and I'm looking down them here. There's some weird ones here. This one here says a built-in thermos pouch. Is that like a Camelback, but it's insulated in the jacket?
Yeah, so you can keep your hot chocolate in it for when you go hiking in the woods and it's the wintertime.
So, like, I just pour hot coffee into the jacket, and then it's got, like, a spout or some sort of...
Yeah, it's kind of... So, like, imagine the jacket... You know, like, where the bottom of your zipper would be? Kind of, like, above your... Well, kind of in your groin area. The pouches. Yeah. So the thermal pouch is located right under the zipper, and then there's a kind of spout that comes out from the bottom there, and you can loop that back up around. It's a very long spout. It's 3 feet. So you take the spout, you roll it up over your arm, and then you can kind of sip on it throughout the day, and kind of keeps your abdomen warm, which is a nice feature too. Mm-hmm. So I like that a lot. We're going to add that in manufacturing.
No. Oh, but is this only limited to hiking, or could I like
do this? No, you can do this in the office. Pour your coffee in it. Why not? However, like it. Probably super hot. Probably super, super hot is probably a way to go. Pour it in your thermal pouch and then sip on it throughout the day.
Wait, but does this work with cold drinks? Like if I had Mountain Dew or something like this, could I also
Thing about thermoses, Dan, how do it know? I don't know. But keeps hot things hot, keep cold things cold. So put your cold beverage in.
Oh,
you can put your iced coffee in. You can put some sort of slushy. I'm imagining you're probably drinking a lot of slushies throughout the day.
Yeah, several.
Numerous slushies. And it has a 72-ounce capacity, so you're going to be fine for the whole day, I think. Actually, that's probably a 2-hour slushie for you, but for most people, probably good throughout the day. Yeah. Put your slushy in it and keep your abdomen cool in that case.
So further down this list, Matt, here, further down this list, I'm noticing now that this one feature says full body airbag for safety.
Yeah, obviously. So here's the thing about our target demographic. They're not buying as many cars as they used to. And we're all very familiar with cars. The main safety mechanism is an airbag. More and more of the people that we are marketing our jacket to are using bikes. They're using some sort of a longboard, things that don't have nearly as many.
Maybe a drone.
Yeah. Maybe they're just tying their jacket to a drone and flying themselves around, taking photos of stuff. Very, very possible. We've decided that we can no longer rely on our transportation for safety. We have to rely on our jackets for safety. So if you are ever in any sort of crash, let's say you're on your bike and you you drive right into a Prius, your jacket will inflate and save you.
Okay. That sounds pretty promising.
I do want to point out, not that I actually want to point this out, more than I'm legally obligated to do so, that there have been we did a couple of tests, a certain percentage of the tests went a certain way.
Well, that's what testing is for, right? I mean, tests go a certain way. That's why you do it.
You know, some like number of tests went a certain way. Yeah. And some people are experiencing that when the airbag inflates, all the electronics are quite sharp and kind of dig into your skin. Say like the corners of all the cables and stuff.
Yeah,
like the
ends of your laptop and your tablet and your iPhone and your Android phone all in there.
So like some percentage of testers have died of puncture wounds. But honestly, if you ask me, I think safety is the most important.
Would have died anyway.
Yeah, would have died anyway. Like
now you're going out with a modicum of pride.
Like the time my friend Steve drove his bike slowly into a fire hydrant and it tipped over, and then his airbag inflated and his lightning bolt cables were thrust into his heart.
his whole rib cage was crushed by his technology squad, his technology entourage.
I feel terrible, but I also feel like he might have died anyway from the bike tipping over.
You can't plan for death.
Yeah. So. You know, minor issues. You know, the other thing I feel like I should probably mention, manufacturing is going great. We have sold hundreds of thousands of jackets, hence the $7 million raised. Because of all the features we've added and continue to add and, like, will not stop adding, there are going to be significant delays in production. It's going to be 10 years, some amount of time before this comes out. So...
I'm just going to say a phrase. I want to see how it lands. Mini Jumbotron on the back of the jacket. Programmable.
I'll be honest. I love it, Andy. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it. How many times have you wanted to say something to someone behind you without dignifying them with actually turning around?
After the show, I'm going to email the manufacturer. We're probably going to add that.
Get onto your...
I do want to point out that while there will be significant delays in the production and thus the shipping, I did call it the jacket of the future, and it's very much going to be that. It's going to be about 10 years.
Wait, that's why it's a quarter century jacket? It's going to arrive in a quarter century?
It will arrive in a quarter century, and it also will not wear out in that period of time. The entire time that you don't have it, it's going to be brand new.
Maybe it's got like a Soylent bladder in it, like a whole layer of the lining is just.
Did you see my Twitter diagram? There was already a Soylent pouch drawn on the Twitter diagram.
I don't follow you on Twitter because of bullshit like this.
Wait, this is a very important thing though. The Soylent pouch isn't the same as the thermos.
No, I mean you could pour Soylent in the thermos pouch if you're a monster.
No. But there's already a Soylent pouch. I just don't want them to intermingle.
Yeah, it's more Soylent pouch is more left breast area.
Right over your heart, where Soylent belongs.
If you remember, I said the thermos pouch is more bottom zipper.
Yeah, just, you know.
Some people call that the groin area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm actually still very excited about that, just because the idea with the long tube and everything. Because I was thinking about it, and I love Mountain Dew. And just be able to, I'm imagining it's a nice clear tube, so you can see like where when it's kind of like a crazy straw where you can see it.
Well,
like,
you mean actual dew from mountains, right? You know, you're out in the woods, you're experiencing the American
nature. No.
You scrape some dew off of leaves off of a mountain, maybe Mount McKinley, a good American mountain.
No, we're talking like about
horrible
the,
foreign mountains.
We're talking about that nice rich yellow liquid. Just seeing that pass through the tube and then straight into my mouth from the thermos pouch area.
Matt, you have to isolate the last thing Dan said. The rich yellow liquid shooting through the tube into my mouth.
I mean, I know you did it on purpose, but we will isolate it.
Oh my goodness.
What Dan's trying to say is he's talking about Mountain Dew, baby.
Yeah, I'm talking about Mountain Dews, baby.
And I think this is just going to make your coworkers want the jacket themselves. I see that as the perfect beverage. You probably want a cool dew. So I see that as a perfect beverage for your thermos pouch.
No, I am super stoked about slurping some dew in the office. This is very exciting.
I'll be honest, Dan, we wouldn't have raised over $7 million if people weren't super excited about this jacket. It's the next big thing. It's the next great American invention.
So, Matt, if you are this message of this jacket, it's really, I'm concerned that you've got a lot to say. You've got some important things on your mind.
I have a lot.
And you're not reaching the people that need to be reached. You need some kind
That's
of place.
It's kind of absurd. I've reached $7 million worth of people.
Yeah, but you know, I've seen the potential of this garment, though, and I think you can go deeper.
You're right.
You know, what you really need to reach people is probably some sort of like central location they could go to get information about this product, to possibly even buy it. It'd be great if it'd be accessible from like anywhere, like some kind of like a store that was
everywhere.
Wait
a minute, like some sort of website?
I guess, sure. A site on the web would probably work, I guess, yeah. But how are you gonna make one of those?
Andy, we can make the site. I have an idea. We can make the site in Squarespace.
Squarespace?
Because this episode is sponsored by Squarespace.
That's good, because that'll be quick and easy for you, and you can just get back to your passion, which is making great jackets.
Because Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas, Andy.
It just gets out of the way and lets you do what you want to do. I mean, how is that not the best? Whatever you're doing, just stop doing it and instead... Well, you don't stop doing it. Wait, I said that all wrong.
Continue doing it. With a site that looks professionally designed, regardless of skill level, no coding required. Also, Andy, the tools are intuitive and easy to use, and if you sign up for a year, you get a free domain.
And they're going to take care of all the hard stuff for you. You don't have to mess around with SSL certificates. You don't have to mess around with handling all of the crap that comes with e-commerce. You don't have to mess around with doing responsive design and thinking about all those weird shapes of phones that are going to be on your website. Squarespace just handles it.
All you got to do is sign up. And if you sign up today, you get a free trial. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code GRID to get 10% off your first purchase and show your support for On the Grid.
Use that offer code. Tell it to your friends. Tell it to your family. Spread it far and wide. Spread the love.
So thank you to Squarespace for supporting 5x5 and On the Grid. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
Squarespace, just stop trying so hard and just do it the easy way. For goodness sake, you deserve it. I mean, we've had enough shows that we've started acknowledging the horrors of the world that I don't know if we have to talk about that exact conversation again, but I am interested in a related conversation,
okay,
which is, given the horrific events in Paris over the weekend, or on Friday, I suppose, I'm curious to kind of return to this thing we've talked about in the past, but maybe not as directly, which is like this thing that creative people do in those moments where they draw a picture or something and kind of put it on Twitter. And in this particular moment, the one that got a lot of sort of mileage and is still all over the place is sort of the peace sign with the constructed of a circle with the Eiffel Tower inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
I am curious to know what you think about something like that at this moment.
I think, like, I don't know if I want to be the person to do that, even though I don't think it's bad. I don't think it's bad at all.
Dan, what do you think about it?
I don't know if it necessarily does any harm, but I really don't think it does any good either. I mean, but I also think every time that a graphic is made, that has to have some sort of a function or a purpose or something. That was just somebody reacting to it and, in my opinion, making something that was more along the lines of, like, artwork.
Maybe I'm revising my statement. It's just, like, if I see it as a frivolous design poster, it makes me a little bit sad. But if I just see it as, like, expressing a sentiment that people would like to latch on to, I'm kind of fine. Like, I don't know what to think. The things I, in general, have a hard time with knowing how to feel about are, like everybody decides to change their profile picture to be, like, stand with Paris. Because in one way, it's like, yeah, of course, I mean, that's great, of course. We should all show our support. And, like, the whole world does a moment of silence. And then one part of me also thinks, like, you would be a monster if you didn't do, like, you would be a monster if you didn't think that. Like, how, that should be assumed. I don't ever want to meet a person that doesn't feel that way. So, like, why do you have to say that out loud? Like, I'm just going to assume that just by knowing that you're not a monster.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to eventually zoom out to more of the sort of visual culture reflecting this thing, right? Which goes much, much beyond an individual designer making a certain image. But I do kind of want to focus on that at the beginning, which is to say that I think if we're being optimistic, if we believe in what we do, is that something that we think does do good in the world, right? Like, I mean, the whole point of branding and of, you know, propaganda posters or advertising is basically to, you know, communicate something to somebody. And in many cases, it's trying to, you know, engage them to action. And I would argue this is some ways doing the same thing, you know, kind of passively engaging people to at least think about what's going on over there and maybe contribute to a charity or do something. If we're being optimistic, that is the idea, right? Like, this thing is a, like, center point around which people and ideas can organize and grow.
Yeah,
right?
It's like one, I think it's one, if for some crazy reason you hadn't heard of it, it would make you go look it up and figure out what is going on. And then two, a thing that people can rally around and feel. Well, you know, the good would be, I think that situations like this can make people feel initially very lost and lonely and not understanding what to do. And so it creates a symbol to feel together. Feel together in some sentiment, even if the sentiment is just pure sadness. So that's not bad. That's not bad at all. I think that the reason I would react in a negative way is because there are times when it can feel opportunistic because it's a person trying to make their mark in the world and then using a tragedy to do so. But it's not really negative. Like, I guess if you're selling t-shirts, you're being an asshole. But if it's just posting an image on the internet, it's not really bad.
I think it's basically impossible to make the argument that it's bad. Like, it's someone posting an image on the internet because they felt a way and they cared about a thing and they, you know, made something about it. If you think that's bad, you're kind of monstrous, I think. But I do think it's on this sort of slope, which descends quickly down into something different but related. And so I feel like this is the purest form of it, right? I believe the design of it that made this particular image is French. So it's not like there's an outsider, you know, that's kind of imprinting themselves on this. So that's kind of like this nexus where these things kind of start. And then you zoom out a little bit, Matt, right? And you go to the people that are all changing their profile pictures, right? To be the French flag. And I've, in some ways, it's the same thing, right? Like, if it's something you want to do, you want to change your thing, you want to show support, that's great. You should be, you should feel totally empowered to do so. There's this really weird thing, I think, about, well, I mean, actually, before we go on, I do want to talk briefly about, so you talk about this kind of mark as representing this idea, as something people can rally around. Is this language, and it's, you know, it's kind of vaguely designed, you can call it design, you can call it art, forget the label, is whatever that thing is the best format for that? Is that why we have sort of, you know, that thing got like 50,000 retweets. Is that why it got so much support? Because it was so visceral and such a good sort of conduit for that message? Is that better than words? Is that better than video? Is it better than something else?
Yeah, I think it's because it's not something... I think words are kind of he's more easily argued, more easily critiqued. Like, I think it's just such a simple and pretty clean idea that's not really, while it is political, it's not, it doesn't really feel political. So there's nothing to argue about. It's just, I get to enjoy it. I get to, or I get to feel like, I get to feel supportive and enjoy it, you know?
Well, yeah, that and the benefit it has opposed to written language is that you don't have to deal with things like translation. Like, if it was written originally in French, then it has to either be automatically translated or somebody has to do it on their own, where if it's just an image, then...
Yeah, although it is worth noting
that... It's not totally true. Like, symbols have cultural meaning, but I think we're talking about things that are universal enough that that's not really an issue for modern culture.
And then my other question about this is, do you think that this thing being, you know, technically informally, like, forget what it stands for, if you can, for a moment. Like, if this is a mark, it's certainly clever, right? The idea that this Eiffel Tower is part of a peace sign. It's well executed. It's, I think it's intentionally made to kind of look a little hastily sort of put together and human instead of sort of corporate and sort of completely structured. Are those aspects of it an important reason into why it becomes an accepted symbol of something like this? Is like the kind of technical formalities you might be taught in a graphic design program that would lead you to make a mark like this, is that important to a success?
I think in this case, definitely, because if it was something that was much more rigid and something that could be used as like a corporate mark or something, it feels like somebody spent a lot of time on it, where this one, it just feels like it was made quickly, so it feels like it very much is in the moment and is very much a reaction to the events rather than some careful consideration that somebody put a lot of effort into to try to make it look good rather than make it feel real.
I think Dan's right. I think it's like, if there were reason to think that, you know, it's the same reason I reacted earlier when I was kind of like, I don't know if I want to be the person to make it. The only reason I say that is because it's not like I'm worried about it being evil or something. I just think that there's the possibility for it to turn opportunistic really fast. And I just like, I don't want to attach to that. I mean, you remember like takes on like Black Lives Matter t-shirts and stuff that popped up on web dev communities and things. And it's like, oh God, man.
Well, so
I don't know. It's turning a message I would like to stand behind into this like weird opportunistic cash grab, and that just feels like the worst.
And that obviously is gross, I think, for sure. And I'm with you, Matt. Like, I will not be the person to do this, partially because I have been in the past. Right, like one of the projects I did in school was for the Haiti poster project, which is very similar. Bunch of designers make posters, sell them, and give.
Oh, I've done that. I mean, I've done that too. I've done exactly that kind of thing before, and so I get like, I totally understand the motivation. I get it. I think it's generally a good thing. So I'm not.
Well, so that's the thing.
Too worried about it. It's just there's a feeling. There's two. It's twofold. There's a feeling of frivolity that I worry about, and then there's a feeling of there's the idea that it could be opportunistic and scummy. So
yeah, I think you really hit on it. But so first of all, it could be opportunistic, and people have done it, things like this opportunistically before, but you know that you wouldn't be opportunistic, so that shouldn't be a reason that you wouldn't do it, right? Like, you know that you're not going to go start
selling t-shirts
or whatever.
No, it's about perception. It's not about how it's about the perception of it, not what I'm worried about doing.
You're just worried people will think you're being opportunistic about it.
Yeah, well, the other thing, too, is, like, you're not always totally control. It's not purely your motivation. Maybe it spins into something that you didn't mean. Maybe someone else puts it on a t-shirt, but that's the thing that you made. You know what I mean? Like, it's not really totally in your control either.
Well,
so,
I mean, nothing's in your control in that sense, right? Like, that's like pretty good argument for never putting any work out there because it could be used something you didn't want to be used for.
Well, it is, I guess. But I mean, like, it's a pretty politically charged.
I mean, like, what if some like neo-Nazi really likes Railway and like makes a poster with Railway on it? Like,
maybe I'm just being emotional about it because like. Yeah, I'm gonna do things like that where I just put a thing in the world and then something happens and how was I supposed to know that was gonna happen? It's gonna happen, but I can see it in somebody else's work and be like, sometimes I'm glad I'm not in that situation.
Yeah, and the reason I'm pushing back on you is because in my heart I feel like this is something I would never want to do after again having done it before in my past. And I think the reasons you described are there. Like, the part is the perception. Like, I don't want people to think that I did it for the wrong reasons. But, you know, if I was afraid of people's perceptions all the time, there's a lot of things I would be paralyzed from doing. So that's not really what's keeping me from doing it. I think more than that, it's this idea that when a certain, like, scale of thing happens, I feel like my natural response is a human one, not one of a designer. Like there's just layers of my humanity, right? And if, you know, someone engages with me on this sort of surface layer, like, sure, I have these labels associated with me. Sure, I have these sort of things that I do. I have these sort of buckets I fit into. And then when, like, a certain degree of severity of something, or a certain degree of importance of something happens, like, you just kind of cut through those layers until, like, and this is just a personal thing, right? Like, maybe for some people, like, their way to cope with something is really to go and make something, in which case, mm-hmm. like, that's a scenario where this seems like it's totally pure and above board. But for me, it's like, I would never feel like I don't want to respond to something like that as a graphic designer. And then I also don't know how you, like, so this is a good example. This is good design. If we're going to call it design, this works really well. And in working really well, it follows the rules of graphic design. So, like, what happens if you do a bad job, right? Like, what are the ramifications of that? Probably nothing, right? No one cares about it. No one pays attention to it. How do you, like, do you have the same sort of loop of, like, self-criticism of your own work as you're making something like this? Like, what is that kind of process like when you're making something? And then, I don't know. It's just, like, it's a hard thing for me to wrap my head around. And so I always have this kind of weird reaction to it, which is not one of criticism, right? Like, I am glad it exists. Somebody was going to mm-hmm. make it. I'm glad it was a French designer that made it. I feel like it's, you know, it's kind of like a natural thing that would happen, right? Like, the language is there. The Eiffel Tower fits that way. It seems like, given enough time and enough sort of context, something that would have sort of come about. So it's not like I have any criticism towards that. It just makes me feel weird to see people responding to something on what is, like, by design, a surface level, right? Like, the whole point of design is to simplify things and sort of whittle them down to something that's ultimately, like, it's a little clever logo, right? Like, it's clever.
Yeah.
And the idea that this sort of horrible tragedy you're going to represent with this little tiny mark in practice doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel respectful and doesn't feel like it has the gravitas of the actual event. And that ultimately is why I think, like, I don't think our tools are equipped to talk about something that is, frankly, as terrible and as complex as, like, what happened in France. And so...
I guess it's, like, our tools in what sense? Maybe our visual language, like, our kind of popularized visual language isn't. Like, I think if you approach it on a human level, you're equipped to do, like, you can decide to talk about it however you want. Like, we're using our voice right now. If you wanted to use some sort of visual medium, like, I don't think that's the handicap. I just think it's because we're using the visual style of a certain thing, which is, like, relatively simple corporate identity.
I'm just saying different methods of communication have different virtues, right?
Like,
words are some of my favorite methods of communication. Actually, even more so than, like, spoken word like this, are words just on a page, because there is really nothing as abstract. Assuming you share a language with your audience, like, there's really mm-hmm. no other way to communicate something with as little kind of bias on it as possible. Like, if I'm speaking, people are going to assume things about my tone, they're going to hear my voice, they're going to assume things about my race, my gender, my background, my age, and all that is going to sort of affect their perception of what it is that I'm trying to communicate. Words on a piece of paper are, like, completely unbiased. And in that sense, I think they're actually, the reason, honestly, I think they've survived so long and been warped and twisted and, you know, still our main method of communication is because of how powerful it is to be able to sort of express a wide range of complexity of ideas without any sort of twist on it necessarily. I mean, obviously there's so much room for interpretation with language that, you know, that's a virtue and also a negative. And I guess I'm just saying that, like, the virtues of, like, graphic design, and I found this to be true in, like, you know, making posters for Haiti. And because I don't want to specifically talk about just France. This applies to, like, you know, making posters for some horrible event to sell and do a thing. This applies, honestly, I think, to, like, the idea of, like, those ribbons on the back of people's cars, for mm-hmm. like research for different diseases. This idea that like, I think this is in some ways like the idea of what the core good part of graphic design should be, right? Like we're able to give yeah. form to a movement, and then everyone can just, you know, as a little identifier, a little signifier, be like, yes, I'm one of those people that is in this group. And I'm struggling with the sort of nature of how giving that shape is inherently kind of flattening and simplifying down things immediately and really, really intensely. And what you get is a bunch of people that I think, you know, maybe don't even understand the root of the thing they think they're aligning themselves with, because we've made it so easy to kind of pay lip service to something, right?
Yeah. The ribbon was an interesting example, because I think it seems more similar to like people changing their profile picture to the kind of gay flag when gay marriage was legalized nationally, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, that seems like a slightly different situation, because it's not such a, like, to me, taking a position on France is like, that should absolutely be a default position, or else you're a horrifying human being. So that seems very obvious. I think situations, if we're talking about the AIDS ribbon or we're talking about the gay flag thing, like that's not as obvious what your position might be. So maybe there's power in expressing that and making someone else feel like they're not alone, which I think is what everybody's trying to do. I think that's the goal of all of this, is making people feel like they're not alone, they can rally together about something. And when it's a more... when it's an issue that doesn't, yeah, there we go. When it's a more divisive issue, I think it does kind of matter, in the same way that like, it gets better campaign matters. And, well, the ribbon one is very interesting, because it went from being almost like a secret statement. Wasn't the origin of it? It was at the Tony Awards, and everyone wore a ribbon on their jacket for a night to, as a kind of like secret nod. As opposed to what it is now.
Where I actually don't know. I wasn't aware of the sort of the full history.
I think the origin of it was a bunch of people who were organizing the Tony Awards wanted a ribbon to kind of, as a kind of an AIDS awareness ribbon before it was really, there's still a stigma attached to it, but when there really was a stigma attached to it, and apologies if this is apocryphal, but I think this is the story.
You'll research it between now and the editing.
They all came up with a symbol. There was kind of just a secret nod to it. Not the whole world knew about it, but enough people wore it that night that it started to catch on. People decided to write about it because there was some curiosity about what it was, and then it raised awareness. And then that has since spun into 10 billion different ribbons, and you yeah. have the kind of Susan G. Komen thing, and now every color means a thing. Like, I think it has power before it becomes trite, and I think it can be beneficial when it's trying to gain support for something that really doesn't have support yet. Like, it's both a divisive issue and one that doesn't have enough consideration. Like, there is a point where raising awareness really does mean something. I think it sounds like a trite thing to say, because everybody's raising awareness about everything all the time, and especially when you're raising awareness about things that are like could not be more in the forefront of culture, like, it starts to lose meaning. But there's a point where that does matter, and that's where these things come up. That's why it's odd when it's the situation like this, where it just feels like everybody in the whole world knows about it and everybody has the same opinion about it, besides like very again horrific human beings. So I like, there are situations where it's powerful, it means a lot, I respect the origins of it, but things can become cliched and lose. Isn't the definition of a cliche a thing that loses meaning over time? And that's just a part of a successful thing, I think.
Well, I guess maybe what I'm responding to is, it seems like the things that we would make as graphic designers are ultimately much more susceptible to becoming cliched than something that actually has some depth and complexity to it.
Well, we're in a lot of ways, we're trying to create something that can get to that point.
Yeah. Which is a goal we should acknowledge, right?
Like, we've kind of studied the things that have been able to do that, and we're trying to replicate them. It's almost like somebody saying, "Let's make something that can go viral."
It's exactly like that.
It's like studying natural phenomena to replicate formulaically. Which, when you say that out loud, that sounds like a lot of things I hate. So that's interesting.
I mean, I think that's exactly what we're doing, though. And
no, it is.
And
it
I just think it's like, it's important. Again, I do not mean in any way to cast aspersions on anybody who is doing this in response to any kind of event, because, you know, free world, by all means, do whatever.
And also, like, I don't feel negatively about it, but it's worth discussing what's actually happening.
Yeah, and not a, that's the thing, is like, I just think that there is some deafness, not even from the people that are making these things, maybe from the people that are like, you know, fans of it, that are adopting it so readily, possibly. There's this like readiness to, like, it almost feels like we've given them the thing that will allow them to basically stop engaging with this issue, because they've just, they stuck this on their profile and now they've said all they need to say, and there's no more yep. sort of conversation around it. It's almost like the thing that ends any further engagement more than the thing that starts it sometimes, which, I don't know, the idea of making something and this is the kind of thing where, like, you know, this particular event is so terrible that, like, even lip service is great, right? Like, I don't, if you're never going to read any articles about the sort of why it happened, or any articles about exactly how it went down or how to prevent it in the future, or sort of the history behind it, you're never going to read any of that. It's not like we don't want people's support to support it, right? Like you said, Matt, like, in this particular instance, it seems like it's a thing where it's like, well, obviously there should be peace, right? Like, only the highest level of human monsters would not want that. But yeah, so let's zoom out a little bit then. So taking it out a little bit to people changing their profile pictures over to certain things, which that particular example actually to me says that all of this sort of enormously, the dozens and dozens and dozens of communication tools we have on the internet are still completely insufficient for the myriad of ways in which humans communicate in the world. And the sort of hijacking of a profile picture with some kind of political or social message is just kind of indicating that I think people do that because they don't want to be seen posting about something that is not about that issue at a time when that's a thing that is sort of fresh. And so a way to do that is to say, okay, I'm going to put, and I don't think this is conscious to most people, but they put the image there and then they can go on posting about you know, their dog or whatever, not at all to their fault. I'm not saying everyone should be talking about this thing, but I think it's a way for people to kind of communicate that this is a thing I'm aware of, I believe is important, and yet I'm going to keep, you know, doing my thing over here because that's what this is for. I don't think we should be only talking about this thing. I would not be okay in terms of my mental health if I only talked and thought about, you know, horrible things like this whenever they happened.
Yeah, it's not an acknowledgement of human existence if you think that you can focus on the one horrible thing for... The other weird thing is, like, how long?
Yeah. Which is exactly, which is...
It's, I mean, in some ways, it's, like, it's a very weird, it's, like, it's a somewhat weird simplification of healthy behavior. Like, if you couldn't live your life and then also have this conversation and maybe even hop in and out of it and have, you know, have laughter in between without feeling like you're offending the world, I don't think that's an acknowledgement of what it's like to be a human being. No. So I don't...
And that's the whole thing.
I don't appreciate that. So it is a somewhat strange simplification of what life is actually like, but it's very distilled.
And it's like in our actual social lives, you know, I think if something of a certain magnitude of good or bad things happen, you know, the greater the magnitude, sort of the further from your deepest inner circles of your closest friends and lovers and whatever, the sort of further from that, you'll start to share that message, right? So something really terrible happens in the world. You'll probably talk about it with your close friends, your close family, maybe coworkers, because it feels like a thing that needs to be mentioned before you can kind of continue on. But almost at no point does something get so huge that you talk about it with absolute strangers, right? That you go through the checkout line at a grocery store and feel the need to talk about whatever this thing is, or that you pass somebody on the street and feel the need to stop them and sort of talk about this thing. Certainly there have been moments in history where things have been that important.
I mean, there are those things, and there are weird little moments of news where that happens, but, you know, I acknowledge your basic premise. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, it's actually, I like it as a case study. It's interesting just to look at how really dumb and, like, primordial our online communication tools are, because we don't have that sort of fidelity in any sense. Like, all we have is, okay, I'm going to be posting things publicly. I need to give myself permission to, you know, move on, but I need to acknowledge this, so I'm going to kind of broadcast it everywhere. It'd be like walking around on the sidewalk with a big sign that said, like, you know, vote for Hillary or whatever, and then you would, you know, make someone read it, and then you would engage with them on some other terms.
But is that a criticism of the tools or just a criticism of online culture?
I think it's the tools. I don't think yeah. there's... Yeah, I mean, the anonymity of the internet is kind of one of its only fundamental bits that it's hard to kind of get away from, in that, you know, everyone's kind of just floating in the fog out there, and who knows who you're actually talking to. But I think more or less people are striving by any means necessary to communicate in this sort of rich cornucopia of complexity that we actually do in our real lives, with a combination of body language, a combination of sort of different levels of intimacy. You know, we're all different people around our different groups of friends and different groups of sort of acquaintances. And we really have no sense of that. I mean, the only thing we have equivalent to that online right now is you have like different accounts on different websites and you can meet different people in those places. But, you know, there's not like one kind of place where these social circles all kind of intermingle and you're able to maintain that kind of diversity. Which I mean, as a criticism in the sense that, like, isn't it interesting that we are still in like the earliest conceivable days of online communication? Not like everyone's doing a bad job and should do better. I mean, obviously they should all do better, but I don't think everyone's like failed. I think it's just like we're at this basic, fundamental, like foundational level where we think we have so much power, but actually we're communicating with each other in like the stupidest conceivable ways. Like just, yeah. you know, little messages shot out to everybody imaginable with no context and no sense of relationships or anything like that.
I wonder if that's always going to be the case, though, because it's just so different, because you're communicating with so many people at once, as opposed to having, even in the like largest form of interaction you can have personally, it's still limited by like people that can fit in a room or something. Because it's not hugely different if you're just communicating to a large group of people in different mediums. You think about like,
well,
even just simple, like the president has to wear a U.S. flag pin, or it becomes an issue. Like that, we need a symbol to remind us that he's always thinking about America, or else we're going to get upset about it because he's talking about other stuff.
I mean, that's only since the invention of the video camera and TV. But
no, I'm saying it's other mediums. I'm not saying it's purely. I'm wondering if it has anything to do with the specific medium and more just the number of people you're speaking to at once.
Yeah, and I think the conceit here is that I'm kind of talking about real life communication as if it's perfect and great and all figured out, but that's not at all the case. Communicating with people in real life is also fraught with challenges and all sorts of other problems. And so it's not like that's the ideal. I just think that I've observed that most people's relationship with online communication is basically a form of publishing. Whether you're posting to Facebook, whether you're posting to Twitter, whether you're posting on some forum somewhere, you are kind of manufacturing your communication, and you are deciding when, what, how, and why you want to publish. And only a very select group of people that spend a ton of time on a certain service, maybe like the three of us have on Twitter or something, do you get to the point where you feel like you're actually just, you know, walls down, just communicating. And even I, well, you're right, I'm in a direct reply.
I actually don't feel that way on Twitter. I feel like I'm coming with little quips.
Well, that's the thing.
Because that's what it's for. Like, even after years of doing the same thing, I think that's not changed.
Yeah, and that's my point, is I feel like for all this communication tools we have, even email, right? Like everything is kind of rigid and formalized and feels like publishing. And I think there's a lot of people that just aren't able to express themselves that way. And more importantly, maybe a lot of ideas that cannot be expressed clearly that way. To finally bring it, I don't want to get too deep in this sort of particular hole in this episode, but to bring it back around, like the people kind of using their profile picture on different social networks or posting images of things is an interesting way to try and communicate something that tool or system will not let them communicate otherwise. And that happens in the real world, like you said, Matt. The president wears an American flag pin. We put this sort of bumper sticker on our car. It's an interesting way to, I think it speaks to the fact that we want to be more of a community than we are, essentially. Like, our desire is to be like, gosh, wouldn't it be great if we could all share something, and this kind of little meme thing that runs around, or everybody changing their profile picture, is like the like little blip of like sort of rippling through the system. But it's like we're only sharing this very dumb, simplified version of something as of right now. We don't yet have the ability either personally or technology-wise to share a complex, rich something. So instead, we're going to share this kind of little blip of something.
Yeah, I still don't think it's totally technology-related. I think it's just telling the world that you're not a stranger. I think it's the same as wearing a t-shirt with a logo on it and hoping that somebody likes the same band you do or whatever.
So why don't you change your profile picture to things when stuff happens that you care about? I don't do it either, but I'm curious why you don't do it.
I think it's somewhat frivolous, and in this very specific, I would probably be more inclined to do it in the gay marriage situation than this situation, because I think it should be so assumed. It's very odd to me that it's not. It's this weird decision where you decide how much time a thing matters for.
Yeah, there comes that day where you're like, today, now this selfie is more important than peace in Paris or than the gay rights movement.
So if I don't make that decision, I don't have to make that decision.
I guess you could just ride from social movement to social movement and never actually go back to a regular picture of you. And just,
that's true.
You know, go from thing to thing.
Yeah, but then we could do that.
Zooming out even further. So I in that general instance, like, so we start with the people making these kind of cultural memes. And I think if that is coming from a place where it's not opportunistic and it's coming from a place where that is the way this person wants to kind of cope and communicate about this event that's happened, that seems beautiful to me and interesting. We talked about all the reasons why personally I don't think that's my way of communicating. They use them out a little bit.
That's the other thing. It's not a judgment.
No, not at all.
I don't want to make those decisions, and I don't want to communicate that way. But I don't really get upset with anybody else for doing
it. No, of course.
It's just...
Which is exactly the same. We zoom out to not profile pictures, right? So now everyone's changing their images to the French flag or whatever, or the sort of rainbow for the sort of gay pride movement. That's the same thing, right? It's the same thing where I don't think I'm going to do it because of similar reasons. Like, I don't want to... make something as simple as that. I don't want to deal with the sort of technology issue of this is the only way to express myself and that at some point I have to remove it. And when does that day come? And all those kind of weird questions. But it's in a similar place, right? Like if it's coming from a good place, a person genuinely cares about a thing and this is a way that makes them feel better about it, then, you know, all power to them, right? That's our position.
I think so. I don't think it's... I mean, I generally feel like if it's not doing any harm, okay.
Okay, so let's keep zooming out then. You know, if
we're going somewhere where I'm going to feel wrong in a second, what's going to happen?
This is what I'm struggling with. So I zoom out a little further. Now we have, I saw a screenshot on Twitter that apparently Uber changed all of their cars in the app over the weekend, and maybe still to this day, to having a French flag over each of the cars on the sort of Uber map when you say you need to get picked up. Now, this is, in theory, the same thing, right? Like, here is a little thing.
In theory.
Here's a little thing that the Uber is going to do, and many other products did a very similar thing. So Uber's just the one I'm going to pick out because its specificity is the soul of narrative. It's a screenshot I saw. So Uber did this thing. They're making a statement. They're saying, we stand for this message. We believe in it. We're going to put it somewhere in our product. Again, in this kind of dumb way that we have no better way to communicate, right? Like, I think similarly to putting user profile picture, right? Like, we have no better way to do this. We're going to slap it on these cars. How do you feel about that?
Now I feel like there's a motive tied. Now I'm like,
but
okay,
what is the motive? There's a reason. Like, that's what I came.
Yeah, well, here I can explain this one very simply.
Oh, good. Please do.
I think this is a situation where maybe they feel like it's just an expression of support, but maybe somebody said, we gotta keep people off Lyft. We gotta show that we're politically active. We should make a marketing decision that gets people on our side, not their side.
Okay, so
we gotta get people don't have positive feelings about Uber. People saw that interview with our CEO on Stephen Colbert, and they think he's an asshole.
He ate a baby.
and then also during I don't know if this is true or not. We enacted surge pricing during this problem, during this horrific event. So we got to get people back on our side. We better do something to make them feel good about Uber.
Well, so
now I'm like, while it's the same action just taken by a corporation instead of a human being, when the motivation, as the motivation of any corporation is to make money, there's almost no other way to handle a corporation. Now it becomes very difficult because, it seems evil to profit off the death of many people.
So here's where I got to push back on this a little bit, because the same thing could have been said if you assumed malintentions about anybody else along the line, right? Like, the person that made a graphic like that could be seeking to get their name out there, to build their portfolio, to, yep, you know, do a thing. They could even be seeking to make it something and then sell it later on, for all you, yep, know. They could sell that mark to Forever 21 to put it on t-shirts next week. The people that are even putting their sort of things on their profile pictures, they could be trying to sort of curry some social status or something. But I, and you as well, are giving those people the benefit of the doubt. So why don't we do the same, yep, for a company like Uber?
I have the ability to empathize with human beings, and I don't have that ability for corporate entities.
See, here's the thing, though. Like, I hate Uber. We've talked about it in this show.
Like, that's the thing. I mean, I know what you're going to say. So let's just let you say it.
Well, first, what do you think I'm going to say? Write it down in an envelope, and then that envelope, okay, is actually you saying it right now.
I'm writing it down.
And then you have to cut this audio out, and after I say it, you have to play this audio no matter what you say. So go ahead, say it. What, okay, am I going to say?
You're going to make the argument that the corporation is made up of people, so it's purely a structure made by human beings that have the same complex emotions, and human beings can have the same motivation corporations.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. You know me really well. I mean, that's the thing that sometimes someone in dealing with Friends of the Web, which is an impossibly small company that has basically no interaction with people except for our clients and our very, very few customers of our products, will make this assumption that we are, like, this attitude will already come into play, right? Like, we're a big company, we're, yeah, out to make money, like, we're just monsters, which, yeah, is not true at all of us. Like, I'm there. I know what we're making decisions based on, and it's really almost never that. We have no problem finding clients. We would never take any action in the public sphere, as far as I'm aware, at this time to go and get more clients. And yet people think that sometimes, because it's really easy to assume that a company is a monster, because that's what capitalism has taught us.
Well, and also because a corporate entity doesn't have the ability to possess empathy, and you just have to trust that.
Look, a
large group of people do.
And we happen to know for a fact that the people that work at Uber are human monsters, so it's easy to not give them the benefit of the doubt specifically. But the thing I struggle with is, like, what do they actually stand to gain by doing that, right?
Yeah.
Like, nobody is going to open their app, and they weren't going to hire a car, but now they are going to hire a car. So it's not going to affect their bottom line appreciably. I can't imagine it would. If someone thinks it would, I would love to hear the logical explanation behind it. Maybe there's an offside chance.
I did say the thing I said earlier about attempting to gain a small advantage over your competitors. You saw a screenshot of it. You didn't open your app and see it and make a decision.
I saw a screenshot of somebody talking about how shitty and terrible it was. So I'm not sure if that was the intent completely.
Those are the people you follow on Twitter. That has nothing to do with the rest of the world.
Well, I mean, I'm saying, is the rest of the world sharing screenshots going, isn't this great? Is that a thing that's happening?
You have to assume that some people are.
I don't know. So I guess it seems like the benefits are so slight, but also my understanding of Uber is so tainted by their past monstrous actions that, you know, obviously, like, I think the people at Uber probably didn't want this to happen in Paris, right? Like you said, Matt, this is such an obvious thing to be on board with that even, you know, some capitalistic corporate a-holes are going to be all about people not getting, you know, blown up. So I struggle with this sort of changing expectations, and I struggle with our inability to express community around an idea in a way that is not reductive.
I also think that we're really in the midst of, like, this, I don't know what, 5 to 10 year window of, like, corporate tone deafness on the internet, like, dealing with social media for the first time, hiring a teenager to run your Twitter account and, like, represent your entire company to millions of people, like, letting the marketing team decide that we're going to put a French flag on an Uber car. I actually think that we'll learn that this is generally not beneficial, and that people, one, make fun of it when it's frivolous, and two, get very offended by it when it's not frivolous. So I think this is in this specific instance, I think it's probably a generally negative thing that will stop happening soon enough. But we're in a weird in between right now. We're, you know, despite being a tech company, not everybody's learned about the internet yet.
So if you are running a company like Uber, or mm-hmm. any big product that has hundreds of thousands, millions of users, you know, do you do anything to acknowledge it? Like, how is it different than just putting a little sign in your, like, you know, ma and pa shop on some main street in anywhere in America that says you support something? Like, is there a way that you can... Here's the other thing I think it bothers me about it,
Matt. Yeah, you can donate money to an organization that is helping victims. I think that you're not... We're not looking to you to give us a message about your stance, like your political stance. It's... Like here's the situation. You run a thing that like is motivated by money. So if that's what your motivation is and that's what you're pulling in and that's what you're good at, then do what you're good at. Give your money to someone that is in need. That's a way to help. It's not making a trite political statement is not actually going to help anybody. So I'm not looking to you for that.
I love it, man.
And I honestly want trite political statement. I will take a trite political statement from a friend because I know where they're coming from. I don't know where you're coming from, and I don't trust you. I'm not going. It's not going to happen. Despite the fact that I trust Friends of the Web and I trust Andy and I trust your small corporation, it's not. I'm not going to start all of a sudden giving people the benefit of the doubt because I also happen to be in a similar situation as you, and I think that there are some companies that are good. For the most part, a situation like this, I don't think it's good. It's at the least, it is silly and frivolous, and at the worst, it is incredibly offensive. So give your money away instead.
I love that I got you to go on a little bit of a rant. That's good. Flip the tables. So why is that expectation not the same of people, right? Like, how many people that changed their profile pictures to a French flag do you think actually took some action in the world to affect any change in the events over there?
Very
gotta
few.
Be
I just
a quarter
think...
of a percent, right?
Yeah.
So why do we look at a company and say, put your money where your mouth is, and look at people and say, isn't this great? We're all a big community.
Because I think when you see a large conceited effort to do something and it ends up being frivolous, it's somewhat offensive. And when you see like a single effort with probably very little thought, like you can assume that when a decision like that is made, that a lot of people were at that table and helping make that decision. When you see a person do it on Facebook, you can just assume it was harmless and maybe stupid and maybe just a way to attempt to show that you're being thoughtful.
The other thing that bothers me about like the Uber situation is I think it really points to a sense of inflated importance, right? Like you said, yes. You said it, Matt, like mm-hmm. No one's turning to you for that. I think a lot of these startups... And I think this because they say it, really believe that they are changing the world in all sorts of crazy ways that are far beyond the purview of their industry or whatever their services are providing. And so I think some of them really think that it's their job to go out there and like be a cultural force.
And I don't think it's just startups. I think it's whoever invented the term lifestyle brand, like I think it comes from the idea that like, well, Coke can't just be about sugar water anymore. Coke has to be about memories. And then when that becomes the situation, and now you're like, oh, well, now we are everybody's memory of Christmas and polar bears. Now, all of a sudden, it's like, well, we need to have, we represent your whole lifestyle. We better have a message. We better put out a tweet that talks about Paris and also Christmas and also like, Martin Luther King Day or whatever weird situation that I'm not really interested in hearing what Coke has to say about it. It's this like, once you can't just compete on the level of like, we make good sugar water and now we have to up things like that. The ante is continually upped, to an absurd level that like, I feel like we almost don't even acknowledge anymore because it's so absurd. Then it seems like that's the place for them to go. But I also think we're starting to see pushback from the general public because it feels so weird and unnatural. And all we really came to you for was some tasty fizzy brown water.
Well, I mean, on top of that, too, it just like that further exposes some of the ignorance that is wrapped around this sort of stuff. Like everything was absolutely terrible that happened in France. Like over 100 people died. Hundreds of people were injured. But the day before, there was a suicide bombing in Lebanon. Like over 40 people died, like over 200 people were injured. And it was an equally terrible thing. But you didn't see anything about like Lebanon flags for people's profiles. You didn't see like a mark made specifically for that. And you didn't see a bunch of brands that latched on to anything for that. It was Another equally terrible experience that happened in a different part of the world, but just it was a difference of ignorance and coverage.
Well, they're latching onto cultural cachet. That's another reason I think you can be skeptical of it, because that didn't. But what you're saying is like the event previous was not acknowledged because it doesn't sell fizzy water. So
yeah,
you're right. I think you're right. Wait, is the show over? Was that it? Is the music playing right now? Put a bow on it, someone. Please put a bow on it.
I thought Dan put a nice bow on it. You could just cut a thing you said.
All right, I guess that's the end. All right, Andy. Yeah, you can't even put a flag on it or something. Tie a little ribbon around it. Overlay some colors on top of your face.
Not even a ribbon.
This has been On the Grid, episode 142. This week, we decided not to do a happy ending, but if you still want to get a recommendation this week, I want you to check out our newsletter, Two Things. Go to tinyletter.com/two things and sign up. You'll get two heartfelt recommendations juxtaposed each week and delivered to your inbox. That's tinyletter.com/two things. Thanks to Dan for the interlude music, Glassboy for the ad music, Girlfriends for the theme music, and finally, thanks to you for listening. Until next week. I have an honest question that I'm about to edit out. Continued jacket bit. Is it funny or do I only think it's funny?
I don't know. I mean, is it funny? You have to tell us.
Matt, it's going to be funny. Just fucking do it.
And why would you edit that? I mean, you said you have a follow-up. Is you actually a follow-up or are you just going to start making more jokes again now you've had a week to think about it?
I'm just going to make more jokes. But...
Well, you've had a week. Let's see if they're good. Come on, bring them on. Yes, I know that area. Go on. Go on.
I have to say everything with a straight face, so this will have to be... We have to bring this back for 1 second. So that's where the pouch is located. So there's a little...
Andy.
Oh, Jesus.